Hello, this is Karen Fresco with the News Gazette, dated Wednesday, June 13, 2018. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Chief Illiniwek Controversy, Pro-Chief Billboard Returns. Eternity brings back familiar sign from time of Illiniwek's removal, by Julie Worth, Champaign. A familiar pro-chief billboard has cropped up in Champaign after a 10-year hiatus. Attorney John Gadow, a staunch chief advocate, said he decided to resurrect the billboard he initially posted across Champaign around the time of the chief's departure in 2007 because of the recent Critical Conversation, which is designed to help the University of Illinois move beyond the controversy. Gadow called that effort a waste of time and money. The people who are pro-chief that talk to the university and think they can reach some reasonable accord with them just were born yesterday. It ain't gonna happen, Gadow said. The billboard, a vinyl sign that reads, The Chief, Yesterday, Today, Forever, is a copy of the 53,000 bumper stickers Gadow printed up years ago. It was put up last month on a billboard on Springfield Avenue, just west of First Street. To longtime chief opponent Stephen Kaufman, the phrase was reminiscent of a troubling slogan from the past, Segregation Now, Segregation Tomorrow, Segregation Forever, from the 1963 inaugural address of former Alabama Governor George Wallace. The phrase has been attributed to Wallace's speechwriter, Asa Earle Carter, a former radio announcer and Ku Klux Klan member, Kaufman noted. Kaufman told U of I Chancellor Robert Jones in a letter that the recent visit by two trustees to the Peoria tribe in Oklahoma to discuss a middle way forward on the chief issue, as well as the chancellor's critical conversation, have emboldened actions to reinstate Illiniwek, in spite of your public statements. It is with appreciation that I acknowledge you have tried to limit the use of symbols associated with Illiniwek. But the most meaningful actions you can currently take to end this truly sad and harmful chapter in UIUC history is to move without further delay to establish a new mascot and have the marching Illini prepare for a new season that does not include any reference to the Illiniwek tradition, he wrote. Gadow said he had no idea that the phrase had any ties to the Klan. That's just balderdash, he said. With all the people we've got on Earth, it's hard to find a good phrase or a bad phrase that's original. It's a free country, but I did not know that. I'm not a Klansman, he said, noting that he attends an African-American church because he enjoys the pastor's sermons. I like his preaching. I don't think Klansmen are going to go to an African-American church. Gadow also put up billboards in 2004, calling for former Chancellor Nancy Cantor to be fired because of her suspected opposition to the chief. The attorney said he was approached this spring by someone who leases the billboard on Springfield Avenue and knew about Gadow's pro-chief stance. Gadow said he can use the space for a year. If nobody likes it, that's fine, he said. If everybody likes it, that's fine. But it's my billboard, politically correct or not. Campus spokeswoman Robin Kaler declined comment on the billboard, but added, The chancellor is laser-focused on bringing as many people of goodwill together as possible to find a path forward together. Based on the response during the initial critical conversation and follow-up events, including with alumni, I think we all feel pretty optimistic that if we can keep people talking to each other and listening to each other, we can find a path forward, she said. After Parkland shooting, armed education. Ex-officer schools teachers in concealed carry class. by Lindsay Jones, Farmer City. Call it professional development. In the weeks following a Parkland, Florida school shooting that left 17 people dead, as public discourse surged with calls for lawmakers to act, retired police officer Rick Noble saw an opening. If it was true that lawmakers could more effectively restrict who gets access to guns, then it stood to reason that they could also make guns more accessible to specific groups. One of those groups, Noble thought, could be teachers. So as the public debate continued, the Adventure Tactical Training owner organized a traditional 16-hour concealed carry course that he teaches with his business partner, Dean Hazen. Only this time, he opened it only to teachers. "We had more than 150 people sign up," he said, "but we had to cap it." During last weekend's two-day training session, a crowd of nearly 30 gathered at Farmer City American Legion Hall. They hailed from mostly rural school districts: Paxton, Buckley, Loda, Blue Ridge, Deland, Weldon, and Mattoon among them. But three came from Champaign County, two from Rantoul, one from Urbana. They were teachers or teachers' aides or custodians or bus drivers, and one superintendent. Most brought their own firearms. Only a handful were male. All were white. What drove them to sign up for the course during their summers, time already filled with professional development courses, grad school homework, and minding children of their own, differed. Some, like first grade teacher Megan Kramer of Hudson, came because it was a chance to take a concealed carry course for free. "I think overall, since it was offered free of charge instead of the $150, we're poor teachers, let's be honest," she said. Others came with thoughts of children and gun violence on their minds. Jeremiah Bennison, a Rantoul art teacher, said if he has the opportunity to carry while teaching, he probably would take it. "Most likely, I would probably be in a situation where I'm going up to the front," he said. "I feel like my size, my physicality, I use it often. I'm not a runner, I'm not a sprinter, but the children are my priority." Sometimes the only way to stop a person with a gun is being a person with a gun. There are a lot of decisions to be made, but I'm here to get the knowledge and see where it will go from there. Ask any teacher and they'll tell you how many duties they already have to juggle in an average school day. Now add a gun to the equation. Former DeWitt County Chief Deputy Mike Walker, for one, believes the situation could be managed. "You have decisions to make, not just in school, but when you're carrying," the newly announced sheriff's candidate told the participants. "This class is the first step in being able to make those decisions. I'm so happy to see so many teachers here, because I think teachers are hesitant to get involved with firearms because of the negativity and all the things that have happened." He was also quick to point out that it takes a lot longer than 2 days of training for anyone, teachers or police officers for that matter, to be ready to act responsibly with a gun. "Don't just come in here and take a 2-day class and think you can handle this firearm proficiently," he said. "It's like anything else you have to work on, teaching abilities and other things. There are situations after 20, 30 years in law enforcement we have to think about if we engage." Under state law, full-time employees with a teaching license already must go through 120 hours of professional development, training in a 5-year period. Just finding the time to carve out most of a weekend for concealed carry training was a challenge, said Julie Smith, who lives in rural Urbana. Plus, many educators on hand last weekend had already received active training through their school districts in the ALICE, Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Counter, Evacuate method. It was a lot for us to come here, just even with grad school, Smith said. I haven't made a decision if they legalize it to have it in the classroom. I'm not sure I would do that. Smith said her uncertainty stemmed from teaching young children in elementary school, where the need to be armed seemed less likely. Secondly, she said, the kids hug us all the time, so I'm not sure about carrying. Noble tried to address that anxiety with a blanket statement. People who are carrying concealed don't have their guns taken from them. He amended that shortly after, saying, It does happen on occasion. Creamer said her school didn't really have a huge problem with fights and stuff, but she knew carrying came with risks. Fifth graders can get pretty big, she said. If there were a couple to gang up on us, you know, that would be a huge problem. Educators on hand learned more than the do's and don'ts of carrying a firearm. Later in Saturday's session, they were coached on the details that experts say make all the difference. Among them, the notion that drawing and stand your ground is how to act. If you're in a shooting situation, you need to be moving, Noble said. And not just moving, there are two types of stances, isosceles and Weaver, that are most effective, he said. Then there's the way the gun is gripped. Grip is everything, Noble said. This is the most important part of marksmanship and what we do in conceal carry. He also covered the proper way to breathe, lines of sight, aiming a gun, even the sound it makes when fired. You don't want to anticipate the bang, he said, but don't squeeze it so slow that you get to shaking. One aspect that is more important than it sounds, Noble told the group, is the cleaning of a gun. You want all the evidence on your side, he said. If you have a dirty gun, all they can tell is that you have a dirty gun. It was a lot to think about, Noble acknowledged, and there's a chance it may never come into play in an Illinois classroom, given that the state is one of 40 where it's illegal to carry a gun on a public school campus. However, a recent push by the gun rights group Illinois Carry has convinced some school boards to pass a resolution that allows them to decide whether and which school staffers could be armed. I think one thing that gets missed is that this is about local control, said Amanda Geary, superintendent of Deland Weldon, which joined Piatt County neighbor Beament in adopting the resolution. No one else in attendance could relate to the training quite like Jared Kimbrough could. He teaches PE at Mattoon High School, where in November a student opened fire in the cafeteria, injuring two before being subdued by a female teacher. You just never know, Noble said it to Kimbrough. You woke up that morning and that was the last thought on your mind. 30 seconds before, you never thought you'd be involved. Have things changed for you? Yes, Kimbrough said, watching the chaos unfold in front of him, with students running so fast they left shoes behind them, and the gun popping like a potato chip bag in the background, left him with a heightened sense of awareness he has yet to drop. That's why I'm here today, he said. Kimbrough said he doesn't know whether teachers should be armed in the classroom, but like Rantoul's Benison, he knew that he wanted to learn as much as possible, just in case. We care about our kids, he said. We want to protect them. That is our highest priority. Federal armed robbery trial. Police track iPhone to nab driver. Victim. Men tied up his mom, cell store workers stole phones. By Mary Schenck, Urbana. A witness in a Kankakee man's federal trial told the jury Tuesday that he was angry that he and his mother and two employees of a Champaign phone store were robbed at gunpoint 2 years ago. Casey Coleman, 25, of Champaign, said he was about to leave the Sprint store to smoke a cigarette when a man wearing mirrored sunglasses came in and stood behind Coleman's mom, who was talking to an employee. "Something told me to stay in the store, so I stayed in the store," he said. The next thing Coleman knew, he, his mother, and two employees were being directed at gunpoint to a rear room of the store at 2706 North Prospect Avenue. There, two men bound them with zip ties, then made off with Coleman's phone and 116 brand new cell phones, most of them iPhones. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ellie Pearson told the jury that the pair got into a waiting car driven by Randy Williams, 28, of Kankakee, who is being tried this week in Urbana for his role in the robbery. The charge against Williams is interference with the commerce by threat or violence, which alleges he aided and abetted others who stole cell phones and electronic devices from the Sprint store. U.S. District Court Judge Colin Bruce is presiding over the trial, expected to go through Thursday. Coleman told the jury that he and the two employees were ordered to lie on their bellies and had their hands bound behind them and their feet tied. After he interceded on behalf of his mother, the robbers allowed her to sit in a chair with her hands tied in front of her. Coleman said that once the men left, his mother testified that she could see through to the front window that they got in a Chevrolet Monte Carlo and took off. He broke his ties and untied the other three. Champaign Police Lieutenant Bruce Ramsayer testified that he was the first law enforcement officer to arrive on the scene. He and a store employee quickly set about tracking Coleman's new iPhone with Apple's Find My Phone app. They learned that the phone was in a car headed north on Interstate 57 and put out alerts to area police. Sergeant Jason Yandell testified that an Illinois state trooper stopped a Monte Carlo on Interstate 57 near Ashcombe that Williams was driving and learned that there were only four or five phones inside it, including Coleman's. "We knew there were a large quantity of phones stolen. We thought that there had to be a second car involved," he said. In opening statements, Pearson said Williams was part of a team of five people who traveled to Champaign in two vehicles to rob the store. She said Williams was the driver of the Monte Carlo that the robbers initially got in before transferring to a sport utility vehicle, and during the switch, they left behind Coleman's phone, which Champaign police tracked to get to Williams. Pearson said that some of the other defendants are expected to testify, hoping for reduced sentences. She said one man has not been found, and three others have pleaded guilty. Only one has been sentenced to date. Williams is represented by Bloomington attorney David Rumley, who urged jurors to keep an open mind about what they will hear over the course of the trial. Charges dismissed. Victim had credibility issues. By Mary Schenck, Urbana. A Champaign County prosecutor dismissed a charge alleging a Champaign man shot another man in Urbana on New Year's Eve. Assistant State's Attorney Tim Sullivan said he dismissed a charge of aggravated battery with a firearm against Levant Neal last week because of significant credibility issues with the 19-year-old victim, who was his only witness. Neal turned himself in on January 19 to face a charge alleging that he shot a man in the arm outside the One South Apartments at 1365 North Lincoln Avenue, Urbana, on December 31, 2017. Sullivan said he had no video surveillance or independent witnesses who could corroborate the man's story about what happened that day. Further, he said the victim continuously gave Urbana police several different versions of what supposedly happened from the start of the year through his last statement in April. Sullivan said the victim ultimately admitted to police that he was selling cannabis at the time of the shooting and said he wasn't entirely honest with police because he did not want to get in trouble for that. Neil had been held in jail from the time he turned himself in, January 19, until the case was dismissed Thursday. Prison sentence, 8 years for subway robbery, by Mary Schenck, Urbana. A Thomasboro man who admitted he robbed a fast food restaurant in Champaign earlier this year is headed to prison for 8 years. Stephen E. Johnson, 31, pleaded guilty Tuesday before Judge Tom DeFanis to aggravated robbery, admitting that on April 6, he robbed a clerk at the Subway, 1101 North Mattis Avenue, Champaign, by indicating he had a gun. Assistant State's Attorney Troy Lozar said that the cashier saw Johnson come in about 1:20 p.m. and that there was a bulge in his sweatshirt pocket. He never took his hands out of his pockets. Johnson demanded money and said he would kill the cashier if it wasn't handed over. The cashier gave $521 to Johnson, who then fled. Johnson turned himself in a few weeks after the holdup. He had been identified on video surveillance, Lozar said. Lozar said Johnson had prior felony convictions for theft, driving under the influence, and driving under revocation. At the time he was charged with a subway holdup, he was on parole for a 2014 conviction out of Woodford County for attempted disarming of a peace officer. He was given credit for 47 days in jail and ordered to make restitution. Battery case sentencing. Probation for biting girlfriend, by Mary Schenck, Urbana. A 28-year-old Champaign man who admitted he hit and bit his girlfriend was sentenced Monday to a year of probation. Dwayne Henderson Jr., 28, whose last known address was in the 500 block of East Washington Street, was also ordered to spend 99 days in the county jail, but given credit for time served. In return for his guilty plea to misdemeanor domestic battery, the state also agreed to dismiss a Class 1 felony charge of unlawful delivery of a controlled substance that stemmed from an alleged sale of cocaine to a confidential source working with Urbana Police on February 14. In the battery case, which happened February 25, the victim told police that she was in the bedroom of her home in the 2000 block of Vauter Street in Urbana when Henderson came in. Assistant State's Attorney Victoria Dedman said the two argued, and Henderson pulled the woman from her room, bit her on the back, and hit her severely several times in the back of the head. The battery happened in the presence of the woman's children. Court records show Henderson has prior convictions for possession of a controlled substance, possession with intent to deliver a look-alike substance, and unlawful use of weapons. Campus Conversation, Julie Wirth's biweekly chat with a University of Illinois professor. The 90-year-old feed mill at the corner of 4th Street and St. Mary's Road is showing its age, so much so that many people who drive by think it has been abandoned, says Kim Kidwell. The Dean of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences would like nothing better than to see the feed mill replaced, but she says the campus isn't quite ready to pull the trigger. In this week's podcast, Julie Wirth talked with Kidwell about that and other topics, including the future of the swine farm, a revamp of U of I Extension, and a new ACES corridor on the Southeast campus. Here's a sample. Developer Peter Fox said last week that the campus might start construction in September on a new feed mill at Curtis Road and Race Street in Urbana. Is that correct? I have to tell you, I learned some things in that News Gazette article that I didn't know myself. We really aren't in a position at this point to make an official announcement on the feed mill, but I'll tell you that we've worked diligently on this project since I got here because it's such an important build for the future of the Animal Science Department and the college, and also the ACES corridor that we really want to establish around the master plan. So we're working very hard to figure out a funding model for the feed mill. We don't have all the money in hand to build it, which is the challenge. The $6 million mentioned in the article, those are internal resources that the college, the provost's office, the president, the university, the VCR, Vice Chancellor for Research, have dedicated to pull together to support the build. So we're halfway there. We're going to have to do some fundraising on the other end to get the rest of the resources that we need together to pay for it. I'm hoping that we make good progress on creating a good plan for financing moving forward, and that we will be able to make an official announcement about what we're going to do in the next few months. I don't know what the timeline is going to be. The price tag quoted was $11 million rather than the $13 or $14 million originally quoted. Has the cost gone down? We started digging into the realities of what we need in a feed mill, and I think the original one that was scoped was bigger than we really need. So we made some adjustments in scope and size, which helped reduce the cost. This is a day when wasting a dime is not a good idea, and we want to make sure we're efficient and effective. Do you have any thoughts on the idea of an ice arena in that site versus the downtown site that the feasibility study favored? This might sound funny coming from somebody within the university. What happens on that site after we leave is none of my business. We want to get out of there and create opportunities for the university to expand in some meaningful way into that space. What goes there is not really my place to make that decision. I know the discussion about the ice arena has been interesting. I think it's exciting to think about having an ice arena at all. Where it's located isn't in my circle of influence, but all I know for sure is that there might be an opportunity to build something there that's magnificent. So I hope that happens. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette dated Wednesday, June 13, 2018. Please stay tuned.